Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, September 2nd. Here on Oahu, rain made the morning commute into town a bit slower today. We are keeping dry, but today we consider a tool developed right here on Oahu that has the potential to help officials gauge the threat of flooding in our streams and reservoirs. We talk about rail construction with Hart. We heard from the city's transit director about operations yesterday. Today we look at the work underway in a critical path, the urban core, where there is little wiggle room. On our show yesterday, we heard how the Hawaii Community Foundation is helping to strengthen our nonprofits. Today, we look at how artificial intelligence can be used to help nonprofits thrive. It's a nod to Tech Week. And we highlight a short documentary about a Maui-based architect who's designing homes that are more resilient against climate disasters.
Support for HPR comes from VertAccount, an outsourced accounting firm in Hawaii. For 15 years, offering accounting and bookkeeping support to local businesses and nonprofits. Learn more at vertaccount.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been raining cats and dogs in Honolulu, which probably impacted your morning commute. Luckily, there's a tool right here on Oahu that's helping us best monitor what's coming down to gauge the threat of flash flooding. This morning, our in-studio guest is Brian Glazer. He's with the company Hohonu, which means deep. It's a local business that was nurtured at the Manoa Innovation Center, an area notorious for flooding. He takes great pride in sharing the humble roots and developing sensors that are helping to provide data to protect life and property across the country. The sensors are in one reservoir here on Oahu, with a plan to install these valuable tools in about a half a dozen others. Here's Glazer.
I'm an oceanography professor at UH Manoa. I've lived here in Hawaii for 22 years. The kinds of things that we always studied in my lab were focused on understanding the environment with sensors and measurements and observations. And in 2014, we were interested in Heia Fish Pond. We were working with the fish pond practitioners there. And the nearest federal tide gauge was just too far away for us to really understand how water was interacting in the fish pond. And that led my research group at UH down the pathway of developing newer low-cost sensors that we could afford to deploy anywhere. We saw there was a demand for that outside of Hawaii, outside of academia, and we launched Hohonu in 2019. Today, we're in 18 states and over 230 locations.
That's awesome. I mean, and I love that the definition of your company means deep, because, you know, your roots run deep just because of how you started. And I love that you had a need. You had a problem and you needed a solution and you created it.
It's meaningful to us, you know, ingrained in the DNA of the company. The University of Hawaii remains a partial equity owner in the company today. They launched us. They got us started. Our roots are from a 400-year-old Hawaiian fish pond that sees environmental challenges today that didn't exist 400 years ago. And so applying contemporary technologies, especially if we can do them cost-effectively to help communities in the coastal zone, in inland, who are seeing more frequent and more intense flooding threats, that's what we're all about.
Yeah, when you think of Mauka de Makai and how that indigenous knowledge is so important, and we have to challenge ourselves, and how do we keep these concepts going and move forward, right, as we deal with challenges that are changing all the time.
Exactly. And to me, having, you know, lived in Hawaii and worked here among the local IA practitioners for a long time, it was really fascinating to see similar problems in faraway places. And Hohonu's first customers were 5,000 miles away in rural South Carolina, saying we're encountering problems like our roads are flooded and didn't used to flood before on these king tide events. What's happening? How do we prepare for this? We have to go pick up our kids early from preschool during high tide flooding events. And again, there just aren't enough granular measurements in the coastal zone or in inland on waterways to do that. And so it really sparked for us that there is this demand out there beyond just a professor and a student, graduating a student, publishing a paper, and moving on to the next project.
Well, tell us about where these sensors are in place now.
Yeah, so we're in 18 states. We're all over the East Coast. We just got back from Texas last week. We have our first inland Texas Hill Country County deployment. And so being an oceanographer, we're really interested, and we're a world player in that coastal zone. But the sensor doesn't care if it's looking at saltwater, freshwater, or asphalt for that matter. So we have a dozen sensors in the city of Boston, Massachusetts, deployed with Boston Emergency Management. None of those sensors are looking at water. Until they're not. They're looking at dry asphalt in flood-prone, low-lying areas. Interesting. And then they're pinging every second, and they're uploading one-minute averages. And so Boston EM, in their emergency operations center, knows, are they sending first responders into 3 inches of water on a roadway, 6 inches, 12 inches? Do they reroute ambulance traffic in real time? So what started as low-cost tide gauges to fill gaps in the coastal zone has really branched out into all of these other kinds of applications, too.
And because we've been hit with these storms this year, where are the sensors in place now?
Yeah, and so here in Hawaii, we had a project funded by Senator Schatz's office a few years ago with our collaborators at Purple Maya Foundation, working with local EA. So we still have sensors remaining from that project across the islands, but we don't have a funded project in Hawaii. We didn't until a couple weeks ago. As Hurricane Lala was approaching, Department of Land and Natural Resources approached us. There was a gauge that was malfunctioning up on Wahiawa Reservoir, and they asked us if we could do a rapid deployment in advance of the approaching storm. With 48 hours notice, our team went up and installed a radar water level gauge next to the existing sensor. And during Hurricane Lala's approach, that federal gauge did go offline. Everybody has gauges go offline. That's not a ding against USGS at all. But ours was able to quickly gap fill and provide that real-time water level data during Hurricane Lala, showing inches of water level within the spillway.
Yes, and we know that the governor was concerned about these tropical disturbances that were forming because he said people don't realize how fast, you know, Lake Wilson filled up with the storms. And he says it doesn't go down fast. It takes like a foot a day. And so he was just worried about what other rains were going to come down and how that was going to affect the communities out there.
Sure. So the Wahiawa Dam, right, the rise was over 20 feet of water level in a day and a half or so. And that, you know, the advisory level goes out when that tops up to about 80 feet, which is approaching the spillway. And so again, our sensors are mounted above the water level, looking down, and they're pinging like a dolphin or a bat using sonar or microwave technology to measure that water level and then feed that data back in real time. We can set up thresholds and text message alerting. All of this information is fully publicly available as well. It's not just for government agencies or scientists. Anybody can go to dashboard.hohonu.io and see NOAA data, USGS data, and Hohonu sensor data as well.
Yeah, and you know, we hear a lot about AI and how it can process a lot of the data that we are collecting at an intense rate. You know, I don't know. So how are you, you know, working with that technology?
Yeah, we use a lot of machine learning and AI algorithms. We have a sensor network of, you know, approaching 230 sensors. The federal government has 300 tide gauges for 95,000 miles of U.S. coastline. So we're not so small anymore. And we're, of course, using our data in addition to providing that public service. In the coastal zone, we're 60% more accurate at predicting where those high tide, king tide events, how high they're going to get. So when the federal government says something like 10% chance of moderate flooding for a region, we can come in and say, with more granular measurements and more sensors in more locations, and the technique that we're using for predictions, we can say something like 98% chance of a foot and a half flooding at this location, and really give a little bit more granularity in advance of these kinds of events.
Well, you know, you were working there at UH Manoa, and, you know, they had those terrible floods, you know, a couple of decades ago. And the Manoa Stream is a problem. You know, all the stuff that comes down is a problem. And I know with the Kona lows, you know, we had the Weather Service forecaster, meteorologist John Ravender talk about, yeah, we didn't anticipate that cell sitting there and pummeling that valley. And I recall watching on TV how some guy came out of Safeway and said, yeah, my car just floated away.
Absolutely. And during the Kona lows, one of our engineers at the Manoa Innovation Center, same thing, lost his car as well. And it, you know, it happens so quickly. And there's a USGS stream gauge right there at the Manoa Bridge. And part of the problem is the way that we've engineered that stream bed and a sharp turn. So stream maintenance is hugely important. I know they're up there working on it yesterday, I saw. We captured some images of that yesterday. It's a problem that's not going to go away, unfortunately, and especially this year. This is the strongest El Nino year that we've seen in probably 150 years. The last time we had a strong El Nino, we had 15 named tropical storms in the Pacific Basin. We've got three right now with a major hurricane at 150 knot winds, you know, just south of us.
Yeah. And so it's something then we need to be cognizant of. If there are tools out there that we can utilize to help protect lives and property, you know, we ought to see what more we can do, I guess.
Absolutely. And we can do things today that weren't possible 10 years ago or even 15 years ago or 5 years ago, both from a hardware and software perspective. And so today, everybody has a computer in their pocket. And the hardware technology that allowed those costs to be cost effective hadn't, in 2014, hadn't really been applied to climate technology or ocean science. And so my group and other groups in academia were applying some of those as research tools, looking to see what could potentially scale. And that's where the University of Hawaii was really great, encouraging me to think about developing a commercialization strategy that could scale to fit that need. And so what we're doing at Hohonu isn't so much research focused as service focused and applying these technologies to really help with these flooding threats.
Yes, I'm a little worried because you said, you know, you hadn't had your sensors here on Oahu, you know, until just recently. So I'm hoping then this opens the door to get these tools out there.
Absolutely. We're psyched to be able to work here at home as well as afar. Department of Land and Natural Resources has now contracted us to make deployments on an additional 6 or 7 reservoirs across the state. We expect that to be able to expand as well. And it's not just gap filling and putting sensors where sensors don't exist today. It is also building that redundancy again. Anybody who puts sensors in the environment knows they're susceptible to damage, loss, theft, vandalism. And now that we have a cost-effective tool, we can afford to do things and add some redundancy into a network that we couldn't afford even a couple of years ago.
Wow. Okay. All right. And then how fast can we get these gauges in these streams?
My head of hardware says he could build 100 a week.
Really?
Right here in Manoa.
Wow. That's impressive. So we can actually make it here as well.
We make everything here. We can't do printed circuit boards here on island, but we source as much locally as we can, all the way down to our cardboard boxes that we ship in, 3D printing tools, machining here on island. Everything is fabricated right up at the Manoa Innovation Center.
Okay. Anaho. Well, thank you so much, Brian, for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Brian Glazer, who's with the company Hohonu, which has developed sensors. The state just put in a North Shore reservoir with plans to add others across the state as we navigate through hurricane season. The weather has impacted lots of construction projects across the state, and we wondered about our largest public works project, rail. The next leg of the project is headed into the urban core, and we've seen milestones with the first column and cap along Nimitz Highway into downtown. We got a chance to sit down with HART CEO Lori Kaikina yesterday afternoon in her office at the Ali'i Tower. We were surveying the cityscape, and she laid out the schedule for what's to come. I had recently driven down Dillingham and was surprised to zip through and not be met with a sea of orange construction cones. Kaikina outlined the plans for the utility work and guideway as we come down Halekuila to the city center station, as well as work that still needs to happen on the west side with permanent parking ride lots.
Right now it's scheduled for the end of this year to be completed, so that's all the underground work. We still have some infrastructure that we're pulling underground, and then we're going to have to pull the HECO cables through, so we're hoping to get that all wrapped up by the end of the year. But in the meantime, you can start to see what we call MOT, maintenance of traffic, has changed along Dillingham. Tudor is a much different animal than our previous utility contractors, so you don't have the 1,000 cones out there anymore. You have the K-rail and those concrete barriers, so you cannot cheat anymore. You cannot make those illegal left turns anymore. It might be a little bit tighter feeling because it's a permanent, semi-permanent barriers there. So really, you cannot turn left unless you're at the major intersections into driveways, and you cannot turn left outside of the driveways. But I think it's a much safer area now for ADA, for the pedestrians, for people who ride the bikes, because those cones would constantly get knocked down and, you know, get out of alignment. So that's the new MOT from Tudor is going from Middle Street to Waikamilo. And it's still only one lane in each direction, but they won't be flip-flopping as much like Nan had to do. on Nimitz Highway, we did get our first, you start to see the columns coming up along on Nimitz. Maybe back up,
because, you know, I have been down Dillingham, and I was impressed that, yeah, the commute was very fast compared to what it's been in the past. And I did think about the trees, because, you know, while we were all sad that the trees had to come down, I was wondering, after this storm, maybe in retrospect, that was probably a good thing.
Maybe a blessing in disguise. HART could have done a better job of communicating to the outdoor circle and the neighborhood, the community, of what was going to happen. So we're trying to not repeat that same mistake when we come down Halekowila. So when we shift over there, I'll share about the tree pruning on Halekowila. But yes, I think, like you said, it is a blessing in disguise. I just met with the HECO executives this morning, and they are still recovering on the Big Island and even here a little bit, and to prepare for the two storms that might hit us, you know, they're checking all of their infrastructure to see where those trees could possibly impact. But you just can't keep up. You just cannot keep up. They have a contractor that does the tree trimming for them, but as soon as you cut them, is it the Albizia? Mm-hmm. I think here they were telling me it can grow 15 feet a year, is it that, or something like that? I'm like, oh my, it grows fast. So yeah, maybe it was a blessing.
And so as we get down into Halekowila, what do residents need to know?
So on Halekowila, we're actually going to start the tree pruning and removals this month, September. And so we are coordinating with the Outdoor Circle and our certified arborist. So 14 of the 64 trees will have to be removed. Three of them are large canopy, and the others are what we call common street trees. We will be replanting those that we have to remove in nearby areas throughout the alignment. And just to stress, the wood will be repurposed. That's why I wanted to show you some photographs, which I know you're radio, but I wanted you to see on the west side and on Dillingham, we repurposed the wood, and it's going to groups like Pa'i Foundation, Kalihi Palama Culture and Arts Society, Kalihi Palama Hawaiian Civic Club, and Kamehameha Schools, and they make just beautiful, beautiful art out of it. So just know, I want your listeners to know that it doesn't just end up, you know, in the dump or at age par. It is being repurposed.
I have seen some of the art, and it is impressive.
Okay. Yeah. Great. So after the tree pruning and removals in September, October, November time frame, we are going to start the guideway construction. So significant access changes to motorists and pedestrians. It's going to be a more phased approach. Unlike Dillingham, it's very methodical. We have the shafts, the columns, the caps. Access plans are adjusted for each phase. There will be some daytime and some nighttime work depending on the location. They are going to start on the Richard Street side as of right now, but things could change. You asked offline about Evie. If we encounter unforeseen things, and Evie's major for us, we know that's a sensitive area, Halekowila, just based on previous studies. So if we encounter something, tutors going to have to be flexible and readjust their starting location. But right now, as of today, we're going to start on Richard Street side.
And then what can you tell us, I guess, refresh our memory, because the whole archaeological survey was something that held up rail before they started. So protocols are in place, right?
We completed the AIS down over here. We have SHPDE's approval, and we do know that's a major sensitive area. So what we have is we have cultural monitors out there. We have architectural monitors out there. Everything is coordinated. If we find anything, the process is in place. Immediately stop. Contact SHPDE, and they guide us on what to do, whether we intern in place, we put them in a respectful place, air condition, and make sure we're very, like I said, respectful towards the EV kupuna. And then at the final resting place, they help us determine it along with the lineal descendants. Does it get interned at the station when it's completed? Does it go in another location nearby? So everything is done per regulations.
Have there been discussions about if it is a large number, then it's plan A, if it's a smaller number, plan B, that kind of
No, thing? Absolutely. So all of that is coordinated through SHPDE. If we cannot avoid, oh God forbid, we have to redesign the location of a column. I'm hoping we don't encounter something that large and significant. But again, we have to be extremely respectful. We will follow whatever the guidance we're given.
Anything else on which you can tell us about, you know, Nimitz, and as you come into that area, and then the final Civic Center station?
Nimitz, we did have our first cap installed on the column. In Ivalay, we had our first, we had our first decorative column. So that was kind of cool. You could actually see an imprint of a choo-choo train. so that was pretty cute. Dillingham, you'll start to see more and more columns coming up. I want to say two already have been installed. To date, we have 30 shafts. That's the underground pukas and 19 columns that have been erected.
Anything else that has proved to be, I don't know, a challenge or a wrinkle or workaround, just given the rising sea level? Because you drive around Ivalay and you know where the... where it's ocean in areas that shouldn't be, right?
Actually, Tudor did encounter two problem areas. One was right here on Nimitz, and one was at Dillingham. The Nimitz one over here, so when they dig the puka, they put in a casing, and the casing actually, you're supposed to bring the casing back up. The casing actually got stuck, and they couldn't retrieve it. So it's actually in place, and they had to redesign, come up, because we can't just, okay, casing is stuck over here, let's just move 3 feet over and dig a new hole. There's no space. So they have to come up with a creative design to accommodate that. So they had to, my guys were describing it as an upside down wedding cake. So instead of coming solid, one diameter all the way down to a certain level, they had to go coming in and go deeper to accommodate for that difficulty they found over there. On Dillingham, the casing did get stuck, but they were able to get it out and then start again. I think they ran into a boulder.
Gosh, so anything else in the near future?
Well, we have our procurements that are coming up. So on the west side, we have the Waipahu Station. So the previous Hart administration valued engineered out the Mackay entrance, and maybe I would have done the same thing to try and save money, but we did get pushback from the community and some legislators that, you know, we really need that so people don't have to cross that busy highway to get to the station entrance. So we, Brandon Elefante was probably the biggest proponent of it, and he's been so patient with us. So finally we have the procurement out on the street, and bids are due in September, and so hopefully we can start that construction soon. We still need to do park and rides out on the west side. So we have East Kapolei and UH West Oahu. The current UH West Oahu was always temporary. So the new one is going to go across the street. So I'm begging for forgiveness now from your listeners. The park and ride is across the street. They will have to walk across the highway, get to the station entrance, go up to the platform, and come back across that pedestrian bridge. We are looking to see how much it would cost, what it would take to have an entrance on that side, you know, where the platform is. But right now it's not in our budget, right? If the GTTT extension, you know, or gets extended, maybe. But as of right now, again, I'm just sincerely apologizing. That was always the plan. East Kapolei, so that would be about 900 stalls. UH West Oahu, the new one, is about 1,100 stalls. And we want to go out to bid maybe early next year for those two park and rides.
So point of clarification, I know we're hearing lots in the news about tariffs. So what can you tell us about the contract and whether or not we're going to be at the mercy of the tariffs, or are we all U.S. made?
We are all U.S. made, but I'm not saying that we won't be affected. The same thing we went through and still going through with COVID, you have supply chain issues. So maybe we always use American made, but if, you know, the tariffs are affecting the non-American made products, so people are jumping ship to now American made, then the supply becomes an issue, that, you know, the more demand for those products. So I can't say that we are immune from that. We could have some residual effects from that.
Okay, all right. Not what we want to hear.
Right.
Yeah, that's the reality.
That is the reality, yes. I just hope people can be patient with us. We try to. It's going to be a little bit different. Like I said, the flip-flopping back and forth on Dillingham, I know, tried people's patience, and even me, confusion driving down where, oh, am I supposed to be on the left side or the right side of these cones? So just please be patient with us, and we'll try our best to not be so disruptive.
That was Lori Kaikina, CEO of HART, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, talking about the timeline for work on the latest leg of Skyline into Honolulu's urban core.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
The U.S. and Mexico are at odds over an outbreak of a foodborne parasite connected to lettuce sourced south of the border. But officials down there say there's no proof the lettuce was contaminated in Mexico.
Because it's so long ago, they don't know what happened, at what point was that commodity contaminated.
Hear that story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater. Carnival of the Nearly Extinct Animals celebrates the natural world through live music, dance, and puppetry September 18th and 19th. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
Tech Week is being celebrated across Hawaii, and today our nod to the efforts of highlighting how it's impacting our lives is to hear how two techies who just sold their startup companies to global businesses are giving back. Rich Matsui and Brent Akamini are the forces behind a free AI workshop to help nonprofit groups. The Hawaii Technology Development Corporation is hosting it at the Entrepreneur Sandbox in Kaka'ako coming up at the end of the month. Matsui starts us off.
You know, when we look at the needs out there in the community, especially in the wake of all these storms that we're all handling, all the nonprofit community that we have in Hawaii are really the front lines in how we as Hawaii address these issues, right? Like when there's a problem, look, we know the food bank's going to be there. And once you have some food, then you know that you're going to be able to go to legal aid if you need some help with insurance policies or what have you, right? Look, we have a whole patchwork of support. However, these nonprofits are also themselves buried under not just tremendous paperwork, but having a tremendously difficult time, you know, securing the funding that they've always wanted and needed in order to fulfill their mission. So at least that's how we see the problem out there.
And you folks are looking at how to use tech to make these nonprofits just more efficient.
Yeah, definitely more efficient. And I think, you know, like Richard was saying, there's a lot of paperwork that needs to happen behind the scenes. And with the tools available now, you can do a lot more with the same resources. And, you know, we've both done things in our careers that were profit-based. And for me especially, I'm looking to give back to help people. And I think that's where we're coming from.
Yeah, and maybe we should back up a little bit, you know, Rich, talk about, you know, the fact that you folks have been successful in selling your startup companies and you see the value of tech and the good it can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, yeah, Brent and I both spent about 2 decades in tech each. And I think that one of the observations, I've had the opportunity to start 3 nonprofits here in Hawaii. And I don't think I've ever had a quarterly board meeting where everyone says, look, guys, we have exactly the right number of resources we need to fulfill the need that's out there, right? This is a conversation that never happens. Every nonprofit in Hawaii is under-resourced, really undergunned relative to what's out there. And so if we can help these nonprofits to really take advantage of this tremendous new technology, which enables us to all have 100 digital employees for $20 a month, as an example, right? Like what a powerful thing that we can enable for these nonprofits. And we did feel like there's a first use case that would be a really good one that we wanted to tackle at this free AI for nonprofits workshop coming up.
Yeah, talk about what these groups can learn at this event.
Yeah, so I think we did a workshop about a month and a half ago, a free workshop for our mid-year fellows. And at that workshop, it was kind of like our test bed for helping. And the one thing that we saw was that just the initial setup for these groups took a lot of effort. So even just the installation of the software and kind of learning how to prompt it and what they should ask initially was a little bit of a hurdle. So I think that's where we'll start. But by the end of the session, they should have a working AI agent that can help them immediately in one of their tasks.
Yeah, at least the first task we're going to go after is a problem that every single nonprofit I know has, which is, how do I find the grants that I'm eligible for? Right, that is a task that takes someone on the team needs to spend several hours a week just going through all the different websites, reading through all the different paragraphs. And that's something that in a two-hour span, we're going to teach every single one of these nonprofits how to build their own AI agent that by the end of those 2 hours, they're just going to, that task will always be done for them automatically every week. And for us, it's not even that being the end goal. It's like, this is teaching them how to fish, right? If we can teach every nonprofit how to make that, then the next thing is to create an AI agent that can do your quarterly reporting as a nonprofit, right? You can start doing your quarterly thank yous to your donors, right? There's so many things you can do once you understand how to build these AI agents. And so like our hope is to take that first step with them all, these 100 nonprofits in a month to help them get there.
Yeah, I mean, because I just think of what we do in our little space with our team. And it's like, oh, why are we spending our time?
I hope you come, Catherine, or get some folks to come. There's 100 seats to this thing.
Yeah, you know, because it just seems like some of this stuff is, it's silly that we're spending time doing this. It's like, hello.
Absolutely, right. I feel like at least no nonprofit person, or at least I don't know anyone who's getting into the nonprofit space because they like to do paperwork. Mm-hmm. They're in it because they love to share people's stories. They like because they love the idea of being able to feed the homeless, right? There's very strong intent that gets you into a space but is not matched by what the day-to-day of job might actually look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about people's passion, right? We do it because we love it, but there's some stuff we don't like to do.
I think the cool thing for me from the first session was seeing everyone, kind of the light bulb moment that went off. Once they saw what the tool could do for them, they were like, oh, okay, I could solve this and this and this with it as well. So I think that was really amazing for me to see from the first event.
Can you give us an example of maybe something that happened when you were working with the Omidyar fellows, you know, that you were like, wow, you know, we can make this work.
Yeah, and I mean, we had about 15 or 20 participants for that first workshop. And, you know, of course, everyone's walking in with, no one knows how to software engineer, there's no programmers, right? Like, we're coming in with, look, here's the goal that my organization has, but how can you use technology to help me to make sure that we're able to fulfill those needs? And every 100% of those participants walked out of the door 2 hours later with their first AI agent. And they were able to build it for themselves, by themselves. And so their ability to then say, I'm going to take that same skill set and do it for five other things in my organization, right? They all learn how to fish.
And you were talking about using Claude and you were telling, was it a dentist? I'm trying to
That's
recall
right.
When you folks were last here in our studios.
Yeah, so I have a friend that is a dentist. He runs his own practice. And I told him about how I use Claude on a day-to-day basis. And from just a weekend conversation, he went off to build a full suite of software that runs his whole dental practice now, saving him $1,500 a month in software costs that he was paying before for a $100 subscription.
So it's that kind of thing, right? Yeah. Where you can really see the results materialize pretty quick.
Absolutely. Same day.
And I think another thing to reiterate is everyone that we hosted at the last event was non-technical. So nobody had any tech background and they were still able to execute this on their own.
Okay, so tell us about this event, when and where, and what are the particulars?
Absolutely. So first, we were doing it in partnership with a couple of organizations. So first, HTDC is hosting it at their Entrepreneur Sandbox. This is going to be on September 23rd, 8 to 10 a.m. And our partners that we're working with are Omidyar Leadership Fellows, as well as the Hawaii Association for Nonprofits, HANO.
And so, gosh, you said you have 100 slots available?
That's right. And we just started letting people know yesterday, but we have 25 nonprofits that have already signed up. So we think this is going to get filled up pretty quickly. So we hope you come.
Well, talk about just the desire, you know, to give back.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I've had enough success in my career, and it took kind of going off to the mainland to learn skills and, you know, eventually come back here. And, you know, I'd like to share as much as I can from what I've learned, best practices, you know, even just kind of the love of exploring tech and how that can impact people. So this is probably the first way for me to give back right now.
And then what about you, Rich? What is it that makes you want to help others in this way?
Yeah, I feel like Hawaii just does a part of our culture. We just really emphasize this idea that if you can, you should help. And I do think that I didn't realize that was something special to Hawaii until I left. And my wife points out, she's not from Hawaii, that these kids who leave do have a strong desire not just to return to Hawaii, but also to do something for Hawaii. And that is a real special asset that we have and continue to hope that we can pass down to our kids.
Well, you know, when we talk about AI, I was aghast to learn. It was something I heard on NPR about pig butchering. And it was a CEO who thought he was in a board meeting with his board members, and they told him to, yeah, this is a priority, write a check to so-and-so. And it turns out it was all AI generated. He was not in a real board meeting. And they wrote a check for millions and they just, you know, they got hoodwinked with this technology. And so when I heard that, I was like, wow, it's just, we're in a whole different universe, and it can be for good or it can be for bad.
Definitely. No, my father got Kapuna scammed not that long ago, right? I think that we all see, just like you said, technology can be used for good or for bad, but like if we can help to empower those in our community that we already know are on the front lines, on the side of good, with these new superpowers that they all have, right? Like, again, 100 digital employees for $20 a month, an incredible asset. You know, how do we make sure that the good actors are able to do their missions?
And then what do you want to do after you launch this webinar?
Well, thankfully, we have these really strong partners that we're working with. So the Hawaii Association for Nonprofits is going to follow up with, after all these nonprofits learn how to use the tools, then the question is going to become, how do you create some of the legal frameworks around the tools to make sure you're using it well, right? So Hano's going to be able to follow up with something along those lines, right? So there's, thankfully, we're not doing this by ourselves by a long shot. Even Brent and I, we have there's 10 other tech professionals are working with us to make this work. We just happen to be the guys that could show up today.
Okay. All right. But this is what, Tech Week or Tech Month, right? So I guess the idea is we just need to raise people's awareness about what's possible.
I think so. It's I think that obviously the news headlines tend to be dominated by a lot of scary things, but also there's an ability for us to use that same technology to do just tremendous good.
Anything else you want to leave our listeners with? I mean, do you think this is the first of a regular thing?
I'm not sure. I mean, okay, honestly, right. Thing we did, I mean, we did it, like Brent said, about a month or two ago. And like the thought was like, let's do this and see how it goes.
Yeah, let's try.
It's very much like an entrepreneurial mindset. Like, let's not try to create a 10-year plan here. Like, let's see what's the next thing we can do. And like, is there people that are going to sign up for it? Are people going to really benefit from it? And if so, like, let's think about what's the 10X version of this look, right? It's like, last time was 15 or 20 people. This time we're going to have 100 people, right? And like, if we think this works, how do we take that next step? We'll probably figure it out at that point.
And I don't doubt they will figure it out. We've been hearing from Rich Mitsui and Brent Akamine, a couple of successful local tech executives who are giving back where they think they can be most impactful.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of commitment to supporting island businesses, sourcing local products from beef and eggs to papaya and noodles.
The growing backlash against flock cameras. People are vandalizing the networked AI-powered surveillance systems. Cities are canceling flock contracts. But is there a better way to resolve the tension between public safety and individual privacy?
It's totally reasonable to talk about how to regulate this technology, but we have some okay, in fact, increasingly high-quality evidence that it really does help us solve crimes.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo, Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to a small but mighty survivor, the palila. Out of 16 historical finch-billed Hawaiian honeycreeper species, the palila is the last one left.
Aloha, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology. We're bringing you a special series called Ahui Manu Minute that explores our cultural connection to Hawaii's native birds. It's built around an ʻole led by Kekuhi Kealii Kanaka ʻole o Haile Lani. Today you'll hear a portion of the ʻole that focuses on the palila. Lisa Mason with UH Hilo Lohe Bioacoustics Lab will guide you through its meaning. Take a listen.
Ukalele a nei au na o kaha ka ia la lani o ho o noho noho a pa. Hua ka I o palila mai kau ai, ai o ahu, mei o ahu, ai molo kai. Ha a lele a kalai o kala au a I na nai, a lele I maui nui. Huli aku kona nuku I alono nui a kea I uka o ka avali I. O lupea ke kumuhau, ke kahu no palilai. Ki ai ai ka la I pala noho I kei. O la maulo I ka nai o me ka mamane noho I uka. O ka palila au na lele a paa, paa hia.
Palila travels from Kauai to Oahu, from Oahu to Molokai. He leaves Kalaiokalaau for Lanai and flies to Maui Nui. He turns his face to Lono Nui Akea toward the shore at Kaʻawalii. Lupea is a hau tree, the guardian for palila. Accompanied by the Laʻipala, which dwells at sea, healthy and ever-enduring through the Naio and the Maʻamane, which dwell inland, the palila flies in droves everlasting. They are secured. About 500 palila remain in the high-elevation forests on the leeward side of Mauna Kea, where they forage on the fruits of the Maʻamane and Naio trees. As you listen to the call of the palila, we invite you to join us in imitating their kani, to offer a pulse of vitality for their success. Mahalo Ahui Manu for today's ʻole, and thanks to UH Hilo Lohe Lab for the recordings of the palila. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Lisa Mason.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges. Learn more about supporting these habitats of endangered Hawaiian birds at friendsofoahunwr.org.
On the next Fresh Air, tech giants like Google, Apple, and Microsoft have donated equipment, held conferences, and/or offered workshops for educators and students. So how much are they influencing how and what children learn? We talk with New York Times reporter Natasha Singer, author of Coding Kids, Big Tech's Battle to Remake the Schools. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Homeworks Construction, helping homeowners considering an ADU with the process from initial feasibility and planning through design and construction. Learn more at homeworkshawaii.com.
A Maui-made short documentary is gaining accolades on the continent. It's called Journey Beyond the Grid, the Hawaii Off-Grid Story, and it follows a Maui architect who has dedicated his professional career to building homes that are more resilient against climate disasters like hurricanes and wildfires. The film won 2 Northern California Regional Emmy Awards last month. HPR's Jacob Alloy spoke with the film's director, Stefan Boker. Boker started by explaining how his production company, Pacific Storytellers, got started.
Pacific Storytellers was born out of, well, really a desire for me to break out of the wedding field, interestingly enough, right? Wedding filmmaking. I still love doing it, and it's wonderful to meet new people, but one thing that has always escaped me there was storytelling. And the ability to shape a story before you ever pick up a camera. And that is what Pacific Story came out of, was born out of, was that desire to first listen, to first observe, and then shape the story from there. And then when you actually do pick up a camera and you talk to somebody, you already have a good idea of where you can steer it based on what you've already heard people talk about.
Hmm. So this most recent project that you've done, Journey Beyond the Grid, it's a profile of this Maui-based architect. For those who haven't seen the film, can you just explain a little bit about the story and then, you know, how you found it and how you began to shape the story into the film that is now out?
So in 2021, David Sellers, who is the principal over at Hawaii Off Grid Studio, design studio, they're a sustainable architecture and design studio based in Haikou, Maui, a small little place in a cannery. And they called me and they said, you know, this was in 2021 when energy was quite cheap still, you know, and they were facing a little bit of headwinds. Off-grid living compared to regular, you know, regular energy use off of the grid was at least perceived to be more expensive. Mm-hmm. And they approached me and said, you know, I think we need to try to let people know that that's really not the case, that, you know, after a certain amount of years, there's a break-even point. And during that whole time, you've got a system that makes you more resilient through redundancies and things like that. So it started off really being a film for a business purpose back in 2021.
Mm. In the film, there's this kind of turning point in the story, mm-hmm. right? When you start off the story, it has that kind of business purpose of let's highlight this group that's doing this thing about sustainability. And then the Lahaina fires happens in the middle, kind of towards the end of what your original project was. And you have to then pivot the story. Tell me a little bit about that pivot.
Yeah. Yes. So after 2021, when we started listening and observing and doing our story finding process with the people at Hawaii Off Grid, and we found, you know, who the heart of our story is and sort of what our plot structure should be or could be or really is. We were all set to go. We had pretty much all the interviews in the can except for one, which was going to be a homeowner who was able to, you know, afford the upfront costs of a fully off-grid system. And that interview was supposed to be on August 9th. Mm. 2023. As we know, August 8th, 2023, the Lahaina fires happened. And I happened to be in Lahaina in the morning on another project. And it was just very dicey. And we finally decided to cut that short and leave, get out as soon as we could. This was before the fires ignited. And on my way back, I called them and I said, I don't know, I don't really have a good feeling about tomorrow. We may want to just scrap it for now and postpone it. Well, as as it would turn out to be, it was what I thought maybe would be postponed by a week or two or something. That interview never happened. The story was put on ice for probably a year as people went through the seven stages of grief, and Hawaii Off Grid, and once they were done with their quick processing of what was going on and their stages of grief, they jumped into action and started really helping in the community, you know, going into the burn zone, helping families there, working with the county to, you know, work through bureaucratic red tape and things like that. David and his team got busy working on temporary housing, which was fully off-grid, you know, with solar panels and batteries, so that displaced people had a roof over their head. And so that changed the story, not only substantially, completely, and one that was now not just off-grid living for a few who could afford the upfront costs, but really something that now it has become almost a necessity for all to build in a bit of resilience into our lives so that we're not at the whim of these disasters that seem to be coming more frequently.
You know, In the film, we hear from the architect, David Sellers. He talks about his kuleana to create, you know, housing that is resilient from climate disasters, you know, creating homes that are off the grid entirely, you know, electricity, mm-hmm. water, wastewater, and also rebuilding homes after these disasters to make them more resilient. I'm curious, what role do you see that this film can play in informing people about this kind of work, especially as we think about the Lahaina fires and also more recently, Hurricane Lala?
Yeah. I mean, well, we live in a place that is far away from everything, right? We have to transport the fuels, the food. And when those shipments stop for whatever reason, a natural disaster or, you know, because of some political games that are being played out there in the world currently, well, what do we do? How resilient are we? Can we withstand such shocks? And when David Sellers speaks, it becomes abundantly obvious that there is something we can do right now in regards to our energy independence, how we can set up our living and working situations in such a way that we're not so dependent on that fossil fuel shipment, right? And that when the grid power goes off, that we can actually still power our chest freezer and our refrigerator and have a light, you know, and all our conveniences, really. So, yeah, this is becoming almost not optional and certainly not a luxury anymore. It feels like something that all of us might want to consider just for everyday living.
I'm curious, you know, you live on Maui. Obviously, David does as well, the subject of the story. There are a lot of projects that sometimes get shelved, right, for an indefinite period of time. That happens in filmmaking. Sometimes stories fall through, the people involved in stories fall through, especially in documentary work. I don't think anyone would have faulted you if you had placed this on the shelf and said, not now, maybe not ever. Why was it important for you to see this story through and work with, you know, that what changed the story?
Oh, well, for one, there was a willingness, not only a willingness, a strong desire on behalf of Hawaii Off-Grid and David Sellers to revisit this and to tell this story. So, I mean, and I'm game to go and to put light on the things that are worthy of finding voice. But there needs to be a willing participant on the other end. And they, you know, when you meet somebody, especially with what you do too, Jacob, you know, when you meet somebody who has such a strong desire and is motivated to make a positive difference in this world, to make things better, even if it's just for one or two people, however small, it is just their purpose. And so when he shared with me his desire to continue, I said, David, I'm with you all the way. Let's go and let's see where this story really wants to go. And that's when together we shaped it in a way which is what we see now, yeah, in the finished film.
And that was filmmaker Stefan Boker and HPR's Jacob Alois. They were talking about his short documentary, Journey Beyond the Grid, the Hawaii Off-Grid Story. You can find a link to the film on our website later today. And we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear about the most profitable company in the state. Want to take a guess who that might be? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.